Now let's hear a rebroadcast of a vintage episode. This is number 29, Propaganda and Control of the Public Mind.
Today we're going to devote the program to the issue of the management of public opinion in America. Professor Noam Chomsky of MIT will speak on propaganda and the control of the public mind. Chomsky's talk was given at the Harvard Trade Union Program in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1997. He starts by saying that there is a war against working people in America.
It should be understood to be a real war, and it's not a new war, it's an old war. Furthermore, it's a perfectly conscious war everywhere, but specifically in the United States, where there happens to be a very free country, but it happens to have a highly class-conscious business class, and always has, and it's very free and open, so you have a lot of information about it. They talk, you have their records. And they have long seen themselves as fighting a bitter class war, except they don't want anybody else to know about it. Occasionally, someone else gets the news, rather famous cases. Doug Fraser, about 20 years ago, 1978, I think, when he pulled out of the Labor Management Council and condemned business leaders for, words were roughly like this, for having decided to fight a one-sided class war against working people, the poor, the unemployed, minorities, even members of the middle class, and for having torn up the fragile social compact that had been achieved during periods of growth and prosperity. In fact, had been achieved primarily, although he didn't say this, primarily through rather militant struggle, very militant struggle under harsh conditions back in the 1930s. Now, the only thing wrong with his statement is that it was way too late. That war that he's talking about was initiated as soon as the fragile social compact was established back in the 1930s, and very openly. You don't have to go to secret records to find out about it, nor do you have to have been at the wrong end of the clubs when the strikes were broken up in the late 30s to know about it. It was completely public. The reason it's not well known is because neither the educational system nor scholarship like Harvard and so on pay any attention to it. It's not a topic that's studied. So there's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda. That's a huge industry. In fact, it extends over the, obviously, the commercial media, but the whole range of systems that reach the public, the entertainment industry, television, a good bit of what appears in the schools, a lot of what appears straight out in the newspapers and so on. Huge amount of that comes straight out of the public relations industry, which was established in this country early in the century and sort of developed mainly in the 20s and on, and has become an enormous industry. It's now spreading over the rest of the world, but it's primarily here. And its goal from the beginning, perfectly openly and consciously, was to control the public mind, as they put it. And the reason was that the public mind was seen as the greatest threat to corporations. That's from early in the century. Business power was strong, but it's a very free country by comparative standards, and it's hard to call on state violence, not impossible, but hard to call upon state violence to crush people's efforts to achieve freedom and rights and justice. So therefore, it was recognized early on that it's going to be necessary to control people's minds. I should say that's not a new insight either. You know, you can read it in David Hume and the Enlightenment, where it was already recognized. In fact, go back to the earliest stirrings of democratic revolutions in England in the 17th century, and there already was concern that we're not going to be able to control people by force, and we therefore have to control them by other means, controlling what they think, what they feel, their attitudes toward one another. I mean, all sorts of mechanisms of control are going to have to be devised. Which will replace the efficient use of force and violence that was available to a much greater extent earlier on, and as has been fortunately declining, you know, not uniformly, but often declining through the years, particularly here, leading to the need for other methods of control. You don't have to move very far from the Cambridge elite to learn about it. The leading figure of the public relations industry is a highly regarded Cambridge liberal, you know, Roosevelt Kennedy liberal, died recently, Edward Bernays, who wrote the standard manual of the public relations industry back in the 1920s, which is very much worth reading. Remember, I'm not talking about the right wing here. This is way at the left liberal end of American politics. His book, it's called On Propaganda, or maybe just Propaganda. I should mention that terminology changed during the Second World War. Prior to the Second World War, the term propaganda was used quite openly and freely for controlling the public mind. It got bad connotations during the Second World War because of, you know, Hitler and that sort of thing. So the term was dropped, and now there's other terms used. But if you read the literature in the social sciences and the public relations industry and so on back in the, say, 20s and the 30s, they describe what they're doing as propaganda. This manual is for the rising public relations industry, and he opens by pointing out that the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is the central feature of a democratic society. It's the essence of democracy, as he later pointed out. And he said, we have the means to carry this out now. He said, we have the means to regiment people's minds as efficiently as armies regiment their bodies. And we must do this. First of all, it's the essential feature of democracy, but also, sort of footnote, it's the way to maintain power structures and authority structures and wealth and so on, roughly the way it is. It's worth remembering something else that they usually don't teach you very much about in school, and that is, if you go back to the origins of American society, it was founded on the principle that was stated very explicitly by the leading framer, James Madison, at the constitutional conventions, as he put it, the primary responsibility of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And Madison recognized, he's a smart guy, that this was going to be a serious problem if a democratic system were established. If people had the right to vote, he used England as his model. England was the model for democracy in those days, right? It's like, we're talking about 1780s. And he pointed out in the debates on the Constitutional Convention something which everybody ought to read in third grade in a free society. I mean, this is the origins of our society, you know. He pointed out that in England, if they had the right to vote, which fortunately they didn't, he said pretty soon you would find people calling for redistribution of property and for a tax on property rights, for what nowadays we'd call agrarian reform. It was mostly an agricultural society. He didn't use the term agrarian reform, but same thing. He said people will start calling for agrarian reform. Obviously, that's intolerable, and we have to protect our own society against that kind of injustice by ensuring that the rights of property prevail.
And that seems to be the heart of the matter. To borrow another forbidden question from Derek Jensen, is the property of the rich more important than the lives of the poor? Because that certainly is the way the system is set up at the moment. As more and more of humanity moves from the aspiring rich into the abjectly poor category, assuming that no fundamental change takes place to the scarcity-inducing capitalist model, that question is going to be on more and more people's lips, I think, capitalist media notwithstanding. Now we conclude the show with the following broadcast from Against the Grain. Thanks to Sasha Lilly for this, an interview last month with the co-authors of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire.
The now established left-wing narrative about the trajectory of the United States in the 20th century is that following the stock market crash of 1929, a much more humane form of capitalism was put in place, with the New Deal and the Keynesian welfare state that constrained the worst aspects of finance and industrial capital. Capital remained in its place, so the story goes, until the 1970s, when the economic crisis of that decade led to the emergence of neoliberalism, in which the state pulled back, finance and markets were able to run amok, and great havoc was created. If only we could go back to that earlier era, we hear on the left, things would be fine. Political economists Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin upend that tale completely. In their magnum opus, the two brilliant Marxist thinkers argue that we must see both periods as central for the creation of a global capitalist system, with the U.S. at the center of the empire, which was shaped and fostered no less under the more social democratic Keynesian welfare state. The book in question is called The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire, and it's published by Verso, and it's the culmination of decades of work between the two men, encompassing, amongst other things, analysis of the capitalist state, the role of the working class under U.S. capitalism, and the question of whether the U.S. empire is in decline. Both Panitch and Gindin teach at York University in Toronto and are collectively the authors of scores of books. Panitch for many years was the editor of the Socialist Register. It's good to have both of you with us. And Sam, I wonder if I can start with you. You write that for the U.S. empire, the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve have played an even more important role than the Pentagon and CIA. How so?
Okay, it's not that the Pentagon and the CIA are irrelevant, but what we're trying to emphasize is that the American empire is not just the latest example of other empires which happen to be dominant and extended political rule into other countries. It's actually a new kind of empire, and that's what we have to appreciate. It's an empire that, in a lot of ways, reflects specifically the fact that it's a specifically capitalist empire, in the sense that it operates through sovereign states rather than just taking states over and having colonies, and it operates very much through markets and institutions and economic institutions. So the key questions are about how do you, in an international world of sovereign states, achieve the reality of other states contributing to the making of global capitalism, what Leo has emphasized as being the internationalization of other states. How does that happen? And how do you create the international context in terms of legal institutions, etc., that allow global accumulation to take place? And it means that the American state is not just representing an American interest, but it's representing the interests of global capital. So the kind of questions we're asking is how did this historically happen? How did the American state develop the interest, the capacity, the responsibility to accept the burden of making that kind of an empire for all of global capital?
Well, this may seem like a self-evident question, but I'm not sure if it is. How do you define global capitalism?
Well, we kind of see it around us every day, and even when Romney and, to a lesser extent, Obama are complaining about China, we see it. Global capitalism is indeed the establishment of markets and capitalist social relations between people. Their dependence on commodities, their necessity of selling their capacity to work to other people in order to get work and get an income. We're seeing that having been established in the last quarter of the 20th century, right around the world. Never before has that happened. We've always spoken of uneven development, and of course, until the turn of China into, by its communist elite, into a capitalist society before the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were large parts of the world that were closed to private markets and capital accumulation. But beyond that, we've seen even in Western Europe and in Canada and in very large parts of the Third World, increasing numbers of people pulled into these types of capitalist social relations. So that there's hardly an aspect of our lives now that isn't, if I can use a fancy term, commodified. And this is something that has been on the agenda of the American state since the Second World War. And you can go back to what the State Department was doing in that period, what the Treasury was doing in that period, with a remarkable degree of awareness that this wasn't something that was going to happen overnight, but with a sense that unless the rest of the world was oriented to free enterprise, as they put it, then free enterprise in the United States would not itself be safe. And that's what happened over a long and complex and contradictory process, but we're now in it. And the American state is largely responsible more than any other, above all through institutions like the Treasury and Federal Reserve, for coordinating with other states, through their counterparts at other finance ministries and central banks, the extension of the type of international law that allows for free trade, that allows for not only free trade in goods, but legal services, financial services, that allows for the free flow of capital, that protects foreign capital just as much as national capital in any country. That involves restructuring other states, but it isn't done usually in a way that is a coercive imposition. It's not a matter of sending in the Marines. It's a matter of an alignment of interests between those institutions of other states and their capitalist classes with those of the United States, but with the United States having the greatest interest and capacity to lead in that coordination of global capitalism.
Just to reemphasize one point that Leo's making that is very important is it's not just something that's happening outside in some international space. It really is about changing what is happening inside states to have them conform with the needs of a global capitalism. So when you have free trade agreements, they're virtually constitutions that limit what you can do internally. So it shapes the pressures of competitiveness, it ensures the free flow of capital, it makes sure there aren't barriers to free trade that are imposed nationally. And the point about it not being coercive is that someone has used the term of empire by invitation, that this is very much social forces inside a country trying to become part of global capitalism because they see it specifically supporting their interests.
But even if this whole kind of reconfiguration of capitalism on a global scale overseen by the U.S. is not necessarily done through the barrel of the gun, force does still have some role in this. So, Panitch, what is it?
Well, I look upon the role of the American military around the world as not that dissimilar from the role of the L.A. Police Department in South Central L.A. That is, its most active role, its most active interventions are in those parts of the world, and, you know, the right calls this rogue states, which are least stably integrated. They aren't nearly as central to the operation of global capitalism as is Europe or Japan or, for that matter, Canada. The notion that the most important thing that the United States has done in terms of the making of global capitalism is the invasion of Iraq is absurd. That's not to say that there wasn't a concern that Saddam should not be able to use oil resources in a way that would be autonomous from the interests of NATO. Of course, that was the factor. But the United States was intervening not in relation to the need to rip off Iraq's oil or guarantee it for exclusive rights for American oil companies. It was to try to contain, much like in South Central L.A., a part of the world which wasn't completely subject to its control. But one can hardly speak of South Central L.A. as being as central to the operation of American capitalism as what? Wall Street. So I think we tend too much to, and it's of course because people are being killed, because this is a most flagrant breaking of international law. It's not surprising that people get outraged by this and call it imperialism, and it indeed is. But in terms of the functioning of the world today, it's much less important than the coordination that the central banks of the world in the G20 and the finance ministries of the world in the G20 do, and within the G20 and the G7 do, in both extending and in managing global capitalism. That is far more important if you're looking at state activity and state intervention than the much more visible and classically imperialist military intervention.
So, Sam Gindin, then, when we're talking about global capitalism, would it be fair to say that this is one way of understanding something that tends to be termed, and it's an awkward term, globalization? And if so, you've started to touch on this, I think, already, but the main theories around globalization tend to presume that what defines it is that states, national states, have pulled back and let markets run amok on a global scale.
Okay, a couple of things. I mean, one is that there's something about the term globalization that makes it seem almost like something is technical and not social. It's somehow a logic to institutions just expanding and getting bigger. We're trying to emphasize that the making of global capitalism, the making of a global economy, has to do with the transformation of social relations. It has to do with the transformation of states. So that's one dimension of it. We're trying to get at the fact that you have to understand this in terms of social relations, and you actually have to understand this historically. And by historically, I mean it's not just a question of time and there's a straight line projection to something. You have to understand how this is made discontinuously, but made through specific things that happen through history, and the American state has been so crucial to that. Now, in terms of the question of states, our argument is that states are absolutely fundamental to making markets. You just can't separate the two. You can't have markets without states intervening in terms of contracts, in terms of property rights, in terms of labor markets. So states are absolutely fundamental. And what happens, some people think that once a company becomes multinational, it escapes the state. Quite the opposite happens. Now it begins to depend on many states. It depends on many states to protect its property and to keep markets open to it, etc. The role of the American state is different in terms of the kind of responsibilities it takes on for managing the global system as a whole.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with the two authors of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. Sam Gindin was the last voice that you heard. He teaches at York University in Toronto. And my other guest is Leo Panitch, who also teaches in Toronto and was for many years the editor of the Socialist Register. So there's a presumption in some sense on the left and within Marxism to some degree that, in a sense, the logic of capitalism is to expand and expand and to expand territorially, to expand in other ways, and that, in a sense, the kind of global capitalism that we're now seeing, which was long predicted and as you say, spans the globe, is the inevitable result of the logic of capitalism. Leo Panitch, is that actually a fair thing to conclude?
It isn't, but it's entirely fair to conclude that Marxism, as well as much of classical economics from Adam Smith and Ricardo on, took the view that markets were naturally expansive. And, you know, here we are, and, you know, yes, if you go back and read the Communist Manifesto, there are many passages there which sound like they're written for today in terms of capital bestriding the whole globe, the bourgeoisie, as Marx puts it, making a world in its own image. But one needs to reflect on the fact about why it took 150 years for that really to be realized. And, you know, someone standing in the Second World War and looking at what had happened over the previous 50 years, when the massive expansiveness of capitalism in the 19th century produced two world wars and a Great Depression, both of which, or all three of which, interrupted globalization. You had tariff barriers, you had capital controls introduced, and you had murderous conflict between capitalist states. you know, you might have said, well, you know, far from globalization being inevitable, it's actually impossible. And to some extent, the famous Austrian-British theorist Karl Polanyi did in fact say that. It's been proven to be impossible. Well, it proved to be possible again, but not without the very active role of states in removing the barriers to globalization. And it was a quite remarkable thing that people like Dean Acheson, who went on to become Secretary of State in 1939, went to the International Lady Garment Workers Union and said, the reason we need to get into the war is so that the United States does finally begin to play the kind of role that will remove those barriers. And that's indeed what happened, but it took a long time. There were loads of contradictions in it. A lot of social forces that were against that needed to be unraveled, both of an extreme nationalist kind, a quasi-fascist kind, which wanted to preserve capitalism in the form of an old imperialism that involved territorial rule and racial domination, etc., associated with the old imperialisms, and of a anti-capitalist kind, whether it was third world left-wing nationalisms, whether it was communism, or whether it was a social democracy that had some vision of a different world. And those needed to be accommodated to or defeated by states and ruling classes those states were representing and in some sense leading. You need to get a lot of things removed, a lot of barriers overcome in order to get to the global capitalism we have today. But even then, it's not a system that operates. It's a chaotic, it's a dynamic system. And because it's chaotic, it throws up crises all the time. So a central role for the state continues to be that of containing these crises. And in the containment of these crises, and it was the American Treasury that in the late 90s said, our major role now is that of failure containment. In the containment of those crises, there are no more important and powerful institutions in the world than the American Treasury and the Federal Reserve. They stand behind the IMF and World Bank and do many, many things that the IMF and World Bank don't even contemplate doing.
Yes, go ahead, Sam.
I think one of the problems was that when you look at Marxism, you don't have a theory of the state that's integrated into this question of capital's tendency to expand. So what the state does can be very contingent. The state might, in representing its own capital, fragment capitalism. It might try to set up empires and colonies that are semi-exclusive. And then you have states that are breaking up and limiting the development of global capitalism. The question is, how did other kinds of states develop and emerge that were internationalized in the sense of taking responsibility for the making of global capitalism and global accumulation within their own territory? And the other kinds of barriers that end up to be very important is the question of the working class. What role does the working class play in trying to limit the kind of restructuring that is restructuring its lives through free trade and the flow of capital, through trying to be competitive? And how did the working class get integrated or be forced into accepting this project?
Yes, and I'll ask you more about the role of the working class in this as we go on. But staying for a moment, Sam, with the question of how Marxists see the state, and of course you both come from the Marxist tradition, so these criticisms are kind of within that rubric. There is a tendency, or there is a history, of seeing the state as simply follows the shots that are called by the capitalist class, that there's sort of an automatic relationship between the two. Sam, how do you think we should understand the capitalist state and its relationship to the class out of which it comes?
Okay, I'll talk briefly on it and turn it over to Leo, because this is really his life's work. It's a mistake to see the state as simply an institution that capitalists call up and tell what to do. Capitalists themselves, first of all, don't collectively often have a general interest. There's an interest, there's all kinds of different interests that have to be dealt with in terms of where they're going. They don't necessarily know what's best even for themselves. They don't see the forest for the trees. The role of the state is that the state has capacities that individual capitalists don't have. And those capacities are involved in thinking about practical responses to problems that deal with furthering accumulation. So on the one hand, the state has some autonomy from individual capitalists or even from capital as a class to do specific things. It's developed those kinds of capacities historically, but those capacities themselves are only relative because it's a capitalist state. So it is still limited by depending on capital to create jobs, to raise revenue. So our argument is very much that we have to understand it as a capitalist state that has a degree of autonomy, but that autonomy is relative. And I'll turn it over to Leo to develop this.
Well, I think Sam said it very well, but, you know, this has been a very weak aspect of Marxism traditionally. Not only Marxism, of course, a lot of radical thought has tended to see the state as merely the instrument of business. One of the great American political scientists, Tom Ferguson, calls it as an investment theory of elections. And, you know, there's something to be understood, obviously, in terms of the role that the Koch brothers are playing in the current election, although there are plenty of billionaires also supporting Obama. But this is an aspect, certainly, of the way capitalist states operate. But it's a smaller aspect than we think. It's exactly as Sam said, insofar as states and capitalist societies are dependent for their own tax base on successful capitalist accumulation and growth, insofar as their legitimacy, as Obama is seeing in spades, depends on the provision of employment to wage workers, insofar as their legitimacy is undermined by mass unemployment. These are the things that make states capitalist states, not because the Koch brothers tell them what to do, but rather because the states, for their own resources and their own legitimacy, need successful capitalism. And over time, the state institutions and agencies get structured in such a way, in terms of the people they hire, in terms of their internal practices, so that everything they do is premised on capitalism, capitalist social relations, capitalist markets, etc. This is the air they breathe as much as the air that Wall Street breathes or any multinational corporation breathes. The difference is that those individual firms are in competition with other capitals. They are looking to a different objective. They are looking to maximize their profits, to maximize their share of markets, to keep their stock prices up, to keep their bond prices low, etc. And states aren't in the markets in that sense. And they, therefore, develop an expertise. Some do it better than others, certainly, which involves, as Sam said, seeing the forest for the trees. As I said before, the Treasury's function becomes that of failure containment. And that is not the function of any particular Wall Street bank. On the contrary, the Wall Street banks look to the Treasury and the Federal Reserve to play that role. And when individual banks don't follow what the Treasury and Fed do as they try to contain crises, they can be made to pay a heavy burden by those very powerful institutions. And they sometimes are. Anyone just needs to think of Lehman Brothers. So I think one needs to see this distinction. And in the 1970s, there was an attempt on the part of Marxists to begin to develop a theory of the state. And it made good progress. But one doesn't make academic careers being a Marxist. And there was an inevitable reaction, mostly on the part of liberals and social democrats. Some of them at Berkeley, I should point out, who responded to this by insisting that there was state autonomy from capital. And in some sense, they were trying to be optimists. They were trying to believe in the Reagan era that you could elect governments who would put a stop to the expansiveness of markets. And they were naive. You know, they tended to look to Germany and Europe and Japan as strong states and tended to define the American state as a weak state because it was market-oriented. And it was very myopic. The American state was never a weak state. And just as they were writing this, the German, let alone the British states and the Swedish state, were more and more orienting themselves to globalization, to supporting it, to encouraging it, etc. Their own capitalists wanted it. It was part of the logic of making a European common market, removing capital controls. And, of course, American multinational banks and corporations very much wanted it, and they were very active players in the making of those other states in the last quarter of the 20th century.
The making of global capitalism dates back, as you argue, quite a bit earlier than that. So I wonder, since you suggest that this is a process that was not some unfolding of iron laws of history, but actually something that was consciously created, how was global capitalism created with the American state at its helm? What was the process and the institutions which allowed that to happen?
Well, you know, it goes back in some senses to the beginning of the 20th century when the Americans were trying to carve out space for themselves inside what were the old empire spheres of influence. Began arguing they were distinctive from those old spheres of influence and that they would represent international commerce as a whole rather than just British commerce or German commerce and so on. You know, that was full of hypocrisy, and Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders certainly weren't doing that. But there was an element to American ideology which counterposed itself to that of the old empires. The dynamism of American capitalism, expressed through the late 19th century into the first half of the 20th century, meant that even when you had isolationist, quote-unquote, governments in office in the 1920s, the most active role was played by the Commerce Department, who was Herbert Hoover, became president subsequently. Most active role was played by the Commerce Department in facilitating the spread of international capital, especially American multinational capital abroad. They weren't isolationist in that sense, even when they rejected the League of Nations. But it took the Depression, and it took World War II, before the American state institutions developed the capacities to play the kind of role that Sam and I are talking about. In a sense, the New Deal got internationalized with not only a strong Department of Commerce, but a strong Department of Labor that was encouraging American trade unions to try to get the kind of trade unionism in Europe and Japan, which would accommodate itself to capitalism rather than oppose it. It took a very strong treasury and an increasingly evolving Federal Reserve as the world central bank to play that role. And this was a learning process for those institutions. It wasn't something that developed overnight. And, you know, we tend to think of the Bretton Woods Keynesian welfare state era as one which was an alternative to global capitalism. It wasn't. And those who created those institutions were well aware of it. In some senses, those institutions, the Bretton Woods institutions, the breather that those arrangements gave to states from the free flow of capital, were designed to be temporary. They were the cradle of what later became neoliberalism, what later became globalization. They nurtured capital back to health. They created the kind of floor below which working class wages did not fall, even when people got unemployed, so that their incomes could sustain consumption. They laid the basis, as was indeed very consciously in the minds of the state players at the time, for what would eventually be the conditions that would allow for free trade and free capital movements. So it's wrong, fundamentally wrong, to counterpose the post-war era of capitalism with the neoliberal era of capitalism. The first was the condition of the second, and it's somewhat like the New Deal. The New Deal brought its financial legislation, the Glass-Steagall Act, the separation of commercial investment banking, brought American banks back to health after the great crisis of 1929 and the massive closure of the banking system when Roosevelt got elected, etc. those reforms were indeed real reforms, and they did regulate the banks and protected people's savings in them to a certain extent, but they were the basis of bringing them back to health. And through the post-war period, finance became stronger and stronger. Labor became stronger too, but it wasn't a zero-sum game. But the banks became much, much stronger. When people say that the current crisis was caused by the removal of the New Deal financial legislation, Glass-Steagall, well, that was a matter of closing the barn door after the horse had bolted. Finance had outgrown the New Deal decades before Glass-Steagall was finally repealed. So we need to get away from this tendency that we all tend to fall into because it's easy, of saying things used to be great in an anti-neoliberal sense in the 50s and 60s. Well, Sam and I grew up in that era, and we remember all too well how capitalist an era it was even then.
Yes, and that seems like a crucial political point because, as you say, particularly since the crisis that started in late 2007, there has been a great deal of nostalgia and turning back towards the New Deal, or hopes to turn the clock back to the New Deal, or if we were able to have these sort of Keynesian aspects of the economy back, that mayhem of capitalism might be somehow ironed out. And Sam, I wanted to ask you to elaborate a bit more about the role of the working class within the Keynesian welfare state, the post-war era that Leo has been sort of laying the ground to describe, where following World War II, these Bretton Woods institutions were put in place. There was a kind of turn towards some version of social democracy. For many people, that seemed like, many people on the left looking back, that the working class had a moment where the kind of intense commodification of society that we've been experiencing in the last three decades, that this was a sort of escape from that, and now that this is being rolled back. How do you think we should understand the role of the working class within the post-war period?
Okay, well, first of all, you have to begin with what Leo said. There's two dimensions of that 50s-60s Bretton Woods period that are crucial. One is, it's exactly in that period that you begin to see the institutions that lead to globalization and, in fact, to neoliberalism being put into place. You've got a period in which finance is actually growing very rapidly. Part of that is through workers' pensions and workers' mortgages. You've got multinational corporations emerging. You've got the first free trade agreements emerging. And what's so important about the working class is that the militancy of the working class is channeled into productivism, which means that it's channeled into them seeing the solution to their problems as growth and individual consumption, as opposed to challenging the power of capital, challenging distribution, looking to really developing strong collectivities. And in fact, through that period, capital is able to make concessions to the strong working class, and the working class does make material progress. But it's material progress that's premised on making those gains within capitalism through individual consumption and through accepting the priority of competitiveness and growth. That's really critical. And to do that, it meant the defeat of the left, of a left that was raising broader questions. So the same period is not only the period in which global dimensions of capitalism are growing, but it's also a period in which workers are being integrated into accepting capitalism as the only world that can exist. The second dimension of this that is so important is this all leads to contradiction. The Bretton Woods system can't last. You can't have fixed exchange rates if you're simultaneously moving towards a global economy of freer trade and multinational corporations running around and finance needing to follow those corporations. So Bretton Woods itself is coming into contradictions. And where the working class is so important is that in the context of full employment, which was a real gain for the working class, but in that context, workers are resisting management. They've got the confidence and the strength to actually resist change, you know, speed up certain changes within the productive process. They're fighting to redistribute income, and that begins to squeeze profits, and it also begins to raise inflation rates. Workers demand higher wages. Corporations try to protect their profits. They raise prices, so you're getting inflation, and inflation becomes a threat to the American dollar. So the Bretton Woods system is suffering both from the material base at home in terms of corporate profits, but also from the impact on the U.S. dollar. And the big question at the time was, could workers go beyond what you've called social democratic reforms and raise the question of control over capital? Because if they couldn't, they would be defeated. And what in fact happens is that in certain cases, there were these broader demands, but they were generally defeated. And neoliberalism comes out of that defeat of the working class. And one of the political messages is that unless workers raise their demands to a higher level, if they just try to make those gains within the context of capitalism and competition, they ultimately end up to be dependent on profits, on corporate power, and are defeated.
Because of time constraints, I'm not going to go into great depth about neoliberalism, which is something that's been covered a lot on this program, and I've talked to you both about it. But as you, Sam, were mentioning, the Bretton Woods institution started really fragmenting in the early 70s. The dollar was taken off the gold standard, and we saw the much increased expansion of the processes that already had been in place, as well as what you describe as a political attack, a political project, an attack on the working class and restructuring of production. At the time, in the 1970s, while this is all happening, there was a narrative that came out of the left, which has continued very much to this day, and certainly the mess that the U.S. created in Iraq, I think, has added to this, that the U.S. as an empire, as a hegemonic power, is in decline. And Leo, I wonder if you can explain why you think that that whole line of thinking, that the U.S. is in decline in this historic role as the imperial power that oversees global capitalism, why you think that's wrong and why you think it's problematic.
Well, you know, ever since the crisis of the dollar was first glimpsed during the election campaign in 1960 between Nixon and Kennedy, when there was a sell-off of the dollar and purchase of gold, and Kennedy pledged to maintain the value of the dollar. Ever since that moment, there have been these predictions of American decline, with the recovery of Japan and Europe by the late 1950s. And what people didn't understand was the degree of integration of these states and of their economies. So that as the dollar crisis was attempted to be coped with, sure, there was a lot of noise and friction, especially between the French and the Americans. The French wanted to go back to the gold standard under De Gaulle, etc. But the main hard work that was done between states, between what were known then as the G10 states, was a matter of central bank and finance ministry officials trying to cope with that problem of exports now coming from Japan and Germany to the United States, and an enormous flow of capital going out of the United States and establishing multinational corporations and American banks inside other states, above all inside the other advanced capitalist states, much more than in the third world, an entirely new development in the history of capitalism. And they were working together and working very much under the leadership of the Americans. And a very famous Greek-French Marxist in 1972, as most other Marxists were saying that the United States is in decline, that inter-imperial rivalry is reemerging, he said, no, American hegemony is not being lost in this crisis. European capitalists are not challenging that hegemony. It's a hegemony they still accept, and they see it as a crisis of capitalism in general, not a crisis of American capitalism. And he was right. And at every moment where there has been difficulties, when the Japanese were exporting so heavily into the United States in the 80s, you got the prediction that Japan was displacing the United States without any sober examination of the extent to which Japanese capital's enormous development was now being oriented to internationalization, to free capital movements. It was the Japanese who opened up their capital markets before anybody else, before Reagan did it for other countries in 1980. And it was the Japanese finance ministry which in every instance followed the lead of the American Treasury in coping with the difficulties of the 80s. And now again, you saw it with the euro. The euro was going to displace the dollar. And all of, and we're seeing it with China today, and
all China
of this fails
right?
to see the deeply integrated nature of these economies, the sense in which multinational corporations are engaged in integrated production, the deep integration of the world's financial systems, but above all, the coordination and integration of states as they manage this global capitalism. And anyone who says today China's about to displace the United States simply needs to ask, is it possible for the Chinese central bank or finance ministry to play the kind of role that the Treasury and Federal Reserve do in managing global capitalism? They couldn't do it. They don't want to do it. Who knows what might happen 50 years or a century from now. But it's a very superficial type of discussion when there is this premature, to put it mildly, prediction of the decline of the empire.
And, you know, the other dimension of it that a lot of people are really raising is a very economic dimension of it. And it's fair to ask that. It's fair to ask whether the U.S. has the material foundation to be an imperial power, and whether it can keep renewing itself. And that was the question that comes out of the 70s. Did the U.S. have that material base for renewing itself? And the point is that it did. I mean, what has to be recognized about what goes on in the 80s and 90s, and one of the reasons that Leo and I have argued that what you've actually got is two golden ages in the post-war period. You've got the post-war golden age from 48 to 72 that workers shared in, and then you've got a golden age from the 80s on that is a golden age for capital. I mean, this is a period in which profits are restored. This concern with prices, which was such a concern for over a decade that they were stumbling through, is actually settled. They break the back of inflation. Inequality, any tendency to equality is reversed. Inequality grows phenomenally. Workers might be feeling hollowed out in terms of what's happening to their jobs, but in terms of what's happening to capital, it's a restructuring of capital, not a hollowing out of capital itself. What you see is that if you're looking at trade, U.S. exports are doing very well. The difference is that they're importing an incredible amount, and they can do it because anybody else would immediately be constrained if they're importing more than they're exporting. But the U.S. is benefiting from everybody wanting to come into the United States because they see the material base for the empire there. So the U.S. gets away with being able to import more than it's exporting. It has a deficit, but it allows it to manage the global economy. It allows it to both legitimate things at home by allowing people to consume more, but also to play the role of the consumer of last resort. And the other thing is that you can't just look at trade statistics. I mean, most of what American companies are doing in terms of being abroad is through multinational corporations, as there are through exports. And you see it in the restructuring of the workplace. You see it in the shift from regionally through the United States. You see it in the ability of the U.S. to move into the high-tech sectors, to dominate the retail sectors. You see it in terms of Japanese car companies coming into the United States and becoming part of the restructuring of the U.S. You see it in, especially in the amazing growth of business services. Anybody who's trying to catch up to the United States or emulate the United States is hiring American consultants and engineers and accountants and legal experts, etc. So there is a phenomenal restructuring in the United States, and the fact that workers are not benefiting from this is a very important part of the narrative. It's that it's the fact that American capital can get away with this, and workers cannot, in fact, share in the productivity to the same extent as they did before, although they're still consuming through credit and extra hours. It's the fact that there's so little resistance to this from the working class that gives capital and the American state the flexibility to continue in the making of global capitalism.
So, Sam Ginn and Leo Panitch, listeners might think, well, okay, so now you've laid out your argument about the making of global capitalism, the role of the United States in it. Why is it, I guess I'll ask you this question, Leo, why is it important that radicals get this analysis right? What are the political implications?
That's the $64 question. I was going to say that, in a sense, the condition for the renewal of American empire was the defeat of the American working class, was the inequality that we now complain about, or we hear Eve Romney complaining about, astonishingly enough, in his unbelievably hypocritical way. But it was the condition of the renewal of American empire that the working class was defeated. And what the conclusion we need to draw from this politically is that it's totally understandable that people should try to find a way to make a better world without having to go through the difficulty of making a fundamental change in society, what is called a revolution. And that doesn't have to be conceived in violent terms. It might be conceived in peaceful terms. But given the powers that be, given the difficulty of changing the whole system, one can see that people constantly look to getting a set of reforms that will do away with inequality within capitalism, that will do away with crises within capitalism. And the liberal reformers and the social democrats and the trade union bureaucracies opted for that in the 1940s and 50s. And they've been trying to renew it ever since. But what we need to understand is that this is a dynamic, if chaotic, capitalist system which will break those reforms when they throw up contradictions. And that was what we've now lived through. And the only conclusion, it seems to me, that is serious, given the way capitalism has evolved, given the enormous power of multinational corporations and international banks today, is that we need to move finally to a politics which is about democratizing the economy and turning a capitalist democratic state into a genuinely democratic state. And that means beginning with an agenda that takes the decisions about what's to be invested, what's to be produced, how things are reproduced, etc., out of the hands of private entities and vesting them in democratic entities. That's not easy, but that needs to be the project. People may call that socialism. They may call it a renewed communism. That's not the point. The point is not the label. The point is we need to create states and social relations that are oriented to democratizing the decisions we make in terms of how we go about producing what we need to sustain our lives.
All right. So we need to go beyond capitalism, in other words.
Yes, in other words.
Thank you both, Leo Panitch, Sam Ginn, for joining me.
Thanks.
As we trot in this dark here, the
and of course, details about the millions of people around the world who are either rejecting or have rejected capitalism as a way of life, as a value system, are firmly off the agenda of the commercially controlled media and firmly on my agenda. I think next week we're going to finish our reading of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years, and I suspect the last 5,000 years. I think it won't be very long before people understand that enslaving others, whether through literal or metaphorical chains, has consequences unwanted in every direction. If you have material that you think is relevant to a post-money world, a world in which people embrace the reality of life and not a symbolic representation of reality, in which the complex decisions we make are not subjected to a simple one-dimensional calculus, in which utterly selfish behavior is treated as normal, then I would be very keen to hear from you. In the meantime, I hope this show has helped you to recognize if you've been brainwashed into thinking there's anything natural about capitalism and markets, and I hope it's helped you to take with a huge pinch of salt anything that anybody from commercially controlled media space says to you about economics. This show and all previous shows are available for download from our webpage at unwelcomeguests.net. Every episode, as well as a description, has a discussion page where you can see the comments raised by listeners, some of who have been very helpful in clarifying the points made by the speakers. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Will Cook, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Keep giving all you can.